The Colorado River supplies water to 40 million people, and that number is predicted to rise even as water levels in the river continue to fall. Harper's Magazine contributing editor Chris Ketchum rafted down the Colorado from Utah to Arizona with an environmentalist and the water manager for the city of Denver, two men who, with dramatically opposed views on how this precious resource should be used. His article, Raising Arizona, is in the April issue of Harper's, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our program today. Hi, Chris.
Hey there.
What did the Colorado River look like when you rafted down it? Are drought conditions immediately apparent?
Well, I went down in September of 2012, and that was a bad year. That was one of the lowest years in recent history, and it was low. It was what river runners called bony. Bony meaning there were a lot of rocks sticking out, and a lot of sandbars, and yeah, it was not pretty.
Well, I remember seeing a report a few years ago about the Colorado no longer reaching the Gulf of California. Is every drop of water in the river being utilized?
Every drop of water is accounted for, and the Colorado has not, in fact, reached the Delta since the probably early 90s. It dries up long before then, and the Delta, of course, is a dying ecosystem as a result because it doesn't get the silt and all that fresh water flowing into it. Yeah, the Colorado has been over-allocated since it was first politically divided in the 1920s with the Colorado River Compact. The assumption back then was that it flowed at upwards of 17 million acre feet and per year, and that is just, it was a huge, a terribly bad assumption because, in fact, the real history of the river, the paleohydrologic history showed that it flowed at more like between 9 and 14 million acre feet. So you had a lot of states that predicated their future development on water that simply did not exist.
Who uses most of the water, agribusiness or the general public?
It's agribusiness, it's agriculture. 90% of between 80 and 90% of all water that's diverted from the Colorado River is used for farming.
And how many states are involved?
Well, you've got the seven states of the Colorado Basin. So you have Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, California, Nevada. Have I missed one? Arizona. And so these seven states came together in the Colorado in the River Compact of 22 to make sure that each one got a share of that river that's so pivotal to their economies.
Well, does one state get more than the others when it comes to the Colorado River?
Oh, yeah, California. California gets more simply because California, under the doctrine of prior appropriation, which is the legal doctrine that governs the Colorado River, had appropriated river water long prior to the other users. And so California was able to basically establish that prior appropriation. And of course, California developed the Imperial Valley as early as 1902, and the Imperial Valley within 20 years became this powerhouse region for agricultural production. California is the big user. California is the glutton.
There are almost 200 dams along the Colorado. What have all those projects and the fact that much of the water is diverted done to the ecosystem of the water, of the river?
Well, it's a tragedy. The Colorado River, I've run all sorts of sections of the Colorado River, and you could run from basically the longest section of it that you could run without a dam is probably from Flaming Gorge Dam in Wyoming down through the Green River, which is the major tributary of the Colorado, and then down to Lake Powell. But elsewhere, you just have dam after dam and reservoir after reservoir. And what they do is they warm up the waters. They impede fish. They take away from the natural flow of the river. And the natural flow of the river is spring melt with huge floods and then drought, just low flow in the summertime. Now, for example, in the Grand Canyon, which everyone thinks is such a wild river, well, in fact, the flows there are entirely dam controlled, and because the water issues out of the bottom of Grand Canyon Dam, well, that water is unnaturally cold, so the entire ecosystem is out of whack. You don't have the kind of native warm water fish that you would have if that was a river flowing at its normal temperature and normal various flow rates throughout the seasons.
I was surprised to learn that some of the artificial lakes, most notably Lake Powell, might be considered Superfund sites if they were completely drained. Why is that?
Well, it's because of all sorts of nasty sediment that's been deposited there over the years. I mean, we're not just talking about pesticides. We're talking about arsenic and selenium and all sorts of nucleotides washed down from the Colorado Basin, which is heavy with uranium deposits, et cetera, et cetera. So if that dries up, you've got this sludge at the bottom, which, the sludge starts to dry out, and the wind kicks it up, and you'll have toxic dust blowing around there for how long, but for a good long period. Then a couple hundred years, maybe, of floods and of some good snows melting and washing it out, you might have a clean ecosystem again. But it'll take a while.
Well, why was Lake Powell created in the first place? Was it intended as a reservoir?
Well, yeah. Lake Mead was created first with Hoover Dam, and then Lake Powell was created to back up Lake Mead. Both were created as systems to allow for development in the Southwest, and both urban development and the expansion of agriculture. Additionally, they were created, or rather, Hoover was created also, not just for storage, but to control the maddening floods that the Colorado was known for. The Colorado, some years it would rage and break its banks and destroy farmland. Other years it would be a trickle. So the issue was control over nature and to subjugate the river. So those two reservoirs are basically man's act of subjugation of this wild creature, the Colorado River.
I'm talking with Chris Ketchum, whose article Raising Arizona is in the April issue of Harper's. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, Lake Powell was named after John Wesley Powell, who went down the Colorado in the 19th century. You traced his journey. What did he imagine would happen to the Southwest after it was settled and developed? And what did he think, who did he think should control water rights in the West?
Well, Powell was, in effect, the country's first bioregionalist. This is a guy who was an amateur explorer, amateur naturalist. He went on to become the second chief of the U.S. Geological Service after basically exploring the Colorado River for the first time, exploring as a white man the Colorado River for the first time in 1869. And that was a trip that went all the way from the town of Green River, Wyoming, all the way down the Green to the confluence of the Colorado and through Cataract Canyon and Glen Canyon and then into Grand Canyon and beyond. So I did not trace his whole journey. I traced a tiny portion of it in Cataract Canyon. Now, after that journey, he embarked on an irrigation survey of the West and became an expert in hydrology. And he determined that, okay, limited waters, limited rainfall, limited snowpack, we have to therefore limit population growth and limit the amount of land that is put into production as a result of irrigation. Of course, boosters in the American West, promoting the American dream, which was limitless growth and limitless acquisition, basically rose up against the man and fought him tooth and nail in Congress and fought him tooth and nail in the newspapers and tried to ruin his reputation and eventually got his irrigation survey defunded and got him kicked out of the U.S. Geological Survey. And finally, America's first bioregionalist was booed off the stage when he made his final address regarding the settlement of the West and the problem of drought in the West, or the problem of lack of water. You know, he said to this crowd, this is a irrigation conference in, I think it was 1901, who said, you know, he said, hey, listen, or no, sorry, the 1893 irrigation conference in Los Angeles. And he said, gentlemen, there is not enough water to do what you're planning. And, of course, the irrigation conference was full of Western boosters who wanted to, they thought, we're gonna settle a billion people here, and we're going to irrigate the entire West with water that, well, doesn't exist, but we're going to do it anyways. And he said, all you're doing is piling up a heritage of legal conflict and litigation and hatred among people who are going to be fighting over a resource, an incredibly limited resource. So he was probably the one truly rational policymaker in the history of the settlement of the West when it came to understanding water and the limitations that that imposes on society.
And then more recently, the Southwest has gone through a tremendous boom. Cities like Phoenix, Las Vegas, of course, Los Angeles is still expanding, and they all want water. And you say that they are competing with farmers. If water scarcity increases, who's likely to get the priority, the cities or the farmers?
Well, market forces will be a determining factor. That is, if the price of water gets high enough and the cities get desperate enough, I think farmers will sell. However, I think that will be that's a long way off. I think a lot of farmers are reluctant to sell out their water rights. And these are old water rights that, under the doctrine of prior appropriation that we discussed earlier, they're not just going to be abrogated. They're not going to be tossed aside. So who will get the water? I think that you're going to have you're going to have more litigation. You have a lot of fighting. You're going to have probably some good amount of backstabbing between the two groups.
Is that already happening?
That is already happening from people I've talked to. That is already happening, yeah, in terms of the signatories of the compact trying to figure out how to deal with the shortages that are coming. And, you know, it's up in the air. It may be that the thing that they will be able to resolve it. That is that the seven states and various industries and interests that all have a straw in the river will somehow be able to resolve their conflicts. But, you know, I talk with some water managers who say that you know, there's a chance of that happening. I talk with others who say no, that they're very pessimistic and they have a very dark view of the future.
Well, this is not a new story. The ancient Pueblo Indians of the Four Corners area, popularly known as the Anasazi, flourished in the Colorado Plateau until their society collapsed around 1300 because it's assumed of dwindling water resources. And that was before we were damming up the Colorado River.
That's right. So we've seen a civilization, a relatively advanced civilization for its time, collapse as a result of drought and water scarcity, and we haven't learned the lesson.
So what does this mean ultimately? Because California is so important as a producer of agriculture in this country, it feeds a lot of the country. Does that mean that we're going to have to forget about that in the near future?
Well,
I think price is going to go up.
The issue, yes, price is going to go up, but I think the real issue is a matter of societal values. It is what we value. If we value production, domestic production of agriculture, then we're going to have to delimit the growth of cities to allow agriculture to continue to produce. If we value creating, you know, metastasizing pathopolises in the American West that probably don't have much of a future down the line anyways, okay, then that's going to be our decision as a society. If we value the preservation of beautiful rivers in the American West that have been carving canyons for millions of years and sustain all sorts of populations of wild mammals and fish life, well, then we'll act to preserve that. So again, it's all a matter of the social values. As far as I see it, our social value is growth and real estate development and real estate speculation and real estate boom, and So we're going to use the water to feed that. However, where are we going to get our food? And what will happen to the prices of our food? Well, the prices will go up, and they've already started to go up. If you look at California, which is suffering a terrible drought, not just in Southern California, which is the part of California directly dependent on the Colorado River, but in the Central Valley. The Central Valley is a huge producer of dairy and eggs, for example. And, you know, both dairy and eggs are up, prices are up 4% over the first couple of months of 2014. Over the same period in 2013, the increase in price was less than 1%. So, we're going to see prices go up.
Just and one more. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Especially because California is so pivotal to a national domestic food production. 50% of all fruits and nuts and vegetables are produced in California.
Well, one of the most expensive federal court cases in history, Arizona versus California, was a water rights case. Are we going to see more a war between the various states of the area, all really thirsty for water?
Again,
would California win?
Yeah, I think California would win because the doctrine of prior appropriation, which is a kind of crazy idea, the doctrine of prior appropriation says if you get to the water first, then you have rights to it. Your rights can exist in perpetuity. And that's not a scenario for social justice because, look, under current doctrine, Arizona can start to go dry. And people in Arizona can start to like see their taps not run. This is an apocalyptic scenario, but an extreme scenario. And California will be just fine. Well, that's not going to be acceptable to our society. So it may be that we'll have to jettison the doctrine of prior appropriation and renegotiate the Colorado River Compact. And in renegotiating it, yes, we might descend into a chaos of litigation. Who knows? Again, it depends on who you talk to. There are optimists and there are pessimists out there who are, equally expert on the river and the history of the river and,
Well, Christopher Ketchum's article, Raising Arizona, is in the current issue of Harper's Magazine. Chris, thank you so much for talking with us.
All right. Well, thank you.